Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. After understanding the awkward condition of Gajendra, who had offered his prayers, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Hari, who lives everywhere, appeared with the demigods, who were offering prayers to him. Carrying his disc and other weapons, he appeared there on the back of his carrier Garuda, and with great speed, according to his desire. Thus he appeared before Gajendra. We have a very short purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur specifically hints that since Gajendra was in such a difficult position and was praying for the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the demigods, who could have immediately gone to his rescue, hesitated to go there. Since they considered Gajendra's prayer to be directed toward the Lord, they felt offended, and this in itself was offensive. Consequently, when the Lord went there, they also went and offered prayers to the Lord so that their offense might be excused. Srila Prabhupada ki. So at the beginning of the chapter, Gajendra, by the grace of Lord Krishna, managed to remember certain prayers he had learnt during his previous birth as King Indrajumna. And only by the grace of Krishna in that difficult situation was he able to recite them. And so this whole chapter has been a recitation of those prayers. Very nice prayers, where he explains the glories of Krishna, his supreme position, his own very fallen condition, and eventually how even he, despite being in such a difficult condition, no longer wishes to keep this great body of an elephant. If you imagine, for an extensive period of time he has been fighting. I don't know what the figure is, 1,000 years I've heard. He's been fighting the crocodile. And he's very tired. The crocodile is showing no signs of losing strength, being in its element. And despite such a great fight for so many years, at a certain point Gajendra has decided during his prayers that he's not interested in this gross elephant body. He simply wants devotional service to the Lord. So at the conclusion of this prayers, this is the result of the prayers. That the Supreme Lord, understanding the awkward condition of Gajendra, appeared with the demigods, carrying his disc and other weapons. And he appeared there on the back of his carrier Garuda, with great speed, according to his desire. So his objective has been fulfilled. Now, whether Gajendra expected the Lord to personally appear, we may not know. What we can say though is that devotees are constantly praying to the Lord in all different circumstances. Sometimes their prayers are for their own protection when they're in difficult situations. Sometimes their prayers are to benefit others. Of course, we know in the Bhagavad Gita four types of person approach Krishna. Jana sukritina arjuna, artha jignasu, artha arti, jnani cha bharata shubha. Those who desire knowledge, those who desire realization of the absolute truth, those who want some wealth, some money, something from the Lord, some of his opulence, or those who are simply in distress. So in this case, Gajendra was in distress. Now, despite all those categories of persons being there, we don't always see that the Lord personally appears on the back of Garuda in response to those prayers. That is a very, very special privilege that the Lord reserves for certain individuals. But also, in accordance with his plan. Because we know that whenever the Lord does something, he often tries to fulfill multiple conditions by doing so. So now, here was a wonderful condition where King Huhu, who had adopted the body of a crocodile, needed to be delivered from that situation. And you also had King Indrajumna, who due to an offense, due to being cursed by Rishi, he had been given the body of an elephant, which also needed to be released at a certain point. And of course the Lord has his supreme plan also to propagate his pastime so that others may benefit from them. So at least in this situation there are these three aspects for why the Lord appeared. Many times the Lord can just do something remotely. Sarvasya Chaham Ridhi Sani Vishnu. He's situated in everyone's heart. So if the Lord desires, if there is a person who is inimical to a devotee, The Lord can very simply just give that devotee a heart attack, give the offender a heart attack, so if he so desires. There's no need for him to come personally to do anything. His energies are fully under his control. And he's the sole master of those energies. He can use them to do anything and everything. But this is a wonderful aspect of the Lord's personality, that in order to protect his devotees, in order to give some pleasure to his devotees, he comes personally and gives them great joy and relief. As we see, even before the end of this series of prayers, Gajendra has no particular desire to hold on to this body. He has lost that desire during the course of his prayers. So really, for the Lord to appear, there is no cause other than to satisfy his own desire and the desire of his devotee. So that is a very special characteristic of the Lord in his interactions with his devotee. In a general sense, we can see that despite a situation of fall down, in a sense, Gajendra's body as an elephant, after having taken his birth as King Indrajumna, was a type of fall down. It's a fall down which happened negligently, perhaps, accidentally. But there may be many reasons why someone is forced to adopt a different situation despite their great previous practice and credits. So in the Bhagavatam, there are many examples of this. Of course, there's the example of Ajamil. We know how, despite having practicing as a very strict Brahmana for many, many years, somehow he just became misled. His senses overtook him, and he indulged in activities he should not have indulged in. And for many, many years he was living a very debauched lifestyle. But still somehow, by the grace of the Lord somehow infiltrated his lifestyle, knowing full well that this is actually my surrendered devotee. But somehow helplessly, due to some circumstance, he is now in a situation where he is not in full control of his actions and his full consciousness. So somehow he inspired that child be called Narayan. And at the end we saw what a great result that brought about. The Yamadutas came. Ajamil was chanting Narayan. Yamadutas tried to take him away. But the Vishnudutas also came because he was chanting Narayan. So then they forcibly stopped the Yamadutas from taking him away. And the Yamadutas, they went back to their master and said to him, "Up until now, O Yamaraj, we have assumed that you are the supreme lord of everything that there is. But it seems that there is a power superior to you. We are entirely confused by this situation. What shall we do in this circumstance?" And then Yamaraj gives them a whole solid, very beautiful discourse on real religious principles. Dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam navai vidurashyo naapi deva nasitta mukhya asura manushya kutonu vityadhara charanadeha. He explains that real religious principles are enacted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Neither the living entities, the ordinary human beings, the asuras, those in the planet of the Vidyadharas, the Charanas, Siddhas, none of them can ascertain what these real religious principles are, because they are directly enacted by the Supreme Lord. And this is what distinguishes spiritual life from a typical material process of inquiry and growth. Because this knowledge does not come from a concocted source. It does not come from any material being. This knowledge is purely spiritual, purely transcendental, and these principles that are laid down are enacted by the Supreme Lord. Of course, the Supreme Lord then has a system whereby these principles are given out. And you can see exalted devotees like Gajendra, King Indrajumna, they practice these principles as they have heard. Now, of course, we know there are certain Mahajans, certain living entities who are entrusted with these principles. Yamaraj goes on to explain that Swayambhu Narada Shambhu Kumaro Kapilomanu Prahlado Janako Bhishmo Balir Vayasakirvayam. These are different individuals: Lord Brahma, Swayambhu Vamanu, Naradam, Lord Shiva, the Kumaras. So many individuals are there who are specifically entrusted to carry and preserve these principles and to explain them properly to those in human society. And yet, despite a whole range, a vast collection of religious principles being there, there are so many shastras actually. There are the original Vedas, there are the Puranas, different categories of Shruti and Smriti, the Upanishads, of which we know Ishopanishad is the foremost. And in this way, there are so many different direct scriptural sources of authority. But then there are also specific directions for those in different conditions. In the Mahabharata, Yudhishthira Maharaj was constantly referring to scriptural injunctions for Kshatriyas, scriptural injunctions for how the ruling class should lead their lives, what they should do, what they should not do. Very, very minute details, discussing every aspect of running a state. Now this knowledge is there, but there is a system whereby this knowledge is disseminated. And despite so many different aspects of knowledge existing, Yamaraj then goes on to explain that etavaneva lokesmin pumsam dharma parasmrita bhakti yogo bhagavati tannama grahanadibi. He explains that despite this vast collection of religious principles, for the human being in conditioned society, bhakti yoga is the way forward. And that bhakti yoga begins with the chanting of the holy name. Tannama grahanadibi. Adibi, it's the preliminary principle in executing devotional service to the Supreme Lord. Now that devotional service alone has brought Gajendra the result that the Supreme Lord has appeared. It is not by his practice of karma or jnana or anything else. Jnana karma dhyanavritam. These things are kicked out from pure devotional service. It is simply a pure surrender to the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord, taking pity on his great devotee, has created a situation whereby that difficult situation acts as an impetus for him to surrender to the Lord. And now that he has surrendered to the Lord is fulfilling his desire and reminding him, A, of the dangers of being cursed by great rishis, but B, also, even if you are cursed by great rishis, if you are situated in devotional service and your intention is to be purely situated at the lotus feet of Krishna, then ultimately nothing can stop that. There are many, many other examples in the Bhagavatam of individuals who have been cursed, individuals who have had to take a temporary break. The example of Jad Bharat is there. Bharat Maharaj was an exalted devotee, became attached to a deer, was forced to take the body of a deer. But in that birth, he remembered his previous lives. Then again he took birth as Jad Bharat. And he gave some quite solid instructions to King Rahugan on just how important it is to maintain a proper devotional attitude to the Supreme Lord. Now in a sense, Jad Bharat had already been offended by King Rahugan. But he didn't act against him. He acted for his benefit and gave him instructions. And King Rahugan is then accepted as a very, very great Vaishnava, because he honored Jad Bharat very much. And in that example, we see that Jad Bharat brings out many, many principles. But he also, despite that two-birth period, where his initial service was broken, he ultimately did not lose out. A similar situation happened to King Chitraketu, and we covered that towards the end of the sixth canto. How somehow inadvertently he managed to offend Mother Parvati. Can anyone remember the circumstance of that story? Yes. Yes. Perfect. So, King Chitraketu on his aeroplane, just to repeat that, he saw Parvati sitting on the lap of Lord Shiva, which is her rightful position. And Lord Shiva is no ordinary personality, and Mother Parvati is no ordinary personality either. King Chitraketu is described had become a little proud at his exalted devotional service. And so he thought it fit to comment, how is it that this great personality, his words were actually meant in amazement. It's not so much that he was trying to insult Lord Shiva. It's described in the purport that he was amazed to see this, and so he expressed that amazement. How is it that such a powerful being appears to transgress religious principles by allowing his wife to sit on his lap, not just in private, like ordinary people would do, but in an assembly of sages. And how come it is that they're not saying anything? It's a highly unusual situation, according to normal standards. But Chitraketu didn't understand it, and he expressed his wonder. Of course, Parvati didn't appreciate that. Lord Shiva wasn't particularly bothered by the situation. So many people are criticizing Lord Shiva constantly. He's just sober, steady. He just rubs off him like water on a lotus leaf. It just falls away without touching him. Of course, that doesn't mean we should deliberately do that, offend Lord Shiva. Very dangerous, as Daksha found out. But Parvati took offense that my great husband, this great devotee of Lord Krishna, is being offended by this impudent rascal. So she addresses him in specific words. She says, "My dear son, my impudent son, please go and take birth in the lower planets." And she's directly telling him that you are completely insignificant. And then he very respectfully worships her after that. And he says, "My dear mother, I do not mind at all this curse that you have given me." Now, is that the normal response that most people would have upon being cursed? It's quite amazing. He says, "My dear mother, I do not mind at all this curse. I simply wish that you will forgive me for my words, which although they were not intended to be offensive, clearly they have caused some offense. So I forgive you for those, I beg your forgiveness for uttering those words." So then Parvati is completely bemused and amazed by this. She's speechless actually. So King Chitraketu goes, he gets sent down to earth, and he appears as who? Dhritarasura. He had a whole wonderful pastime of Dhritarasura. But then Lord Shiva engages in a whole dialogue with Parvati. And in this dialogue he explains that Narayana Parasarve na kutaschana bibhyati. Those who are fully engaged in the service of Narayana, Parasarve, his topmost devotees, na kutaschana bibhyati, they have no fear anywhere. Swarga apavarga narakeshu apituliyartha darshinaha. Whether they are in the heavenly planets, the hellish planets, or in the middle planets, it is all the same. They are not simply not bothered. They simply engage in the chanting of the holy name and in devotional service. Swargapavarga narakeshu apituliyartha darshina. They are simply engaged in your loving devotional service. So he's glorifying the position of a devotee. That how wonderful is this devotee that despite such a tremendous calamity happening, he is completely equipoised. Now this is really a benediction that is given only to devotees. This material world is a very fearful place. And if you read some of the descriptions in the fifth canto, what happens to the living entity when he first encounters these Yamadutas? The living entity is so afraid when he sees these fearful people who are about to take him away to receive his dues for his very sinful life. The living entity passes urine, passes stool, is in a completely dejected, miserable, depressed condition. In this verse, I thought it was quite a nice understatement that in the translation, Atam tadvad artam upalabhya jagan nivasaha. Unto him Gajendra, tadvad, in that way, artam, who was very depressed because of being attacked by the crocodile. Now it has a certain understated elegance, that statement. That you have this tremendous crocodile which has grabbed you for 1,000 years, is pulling you under the water, and your entire life is about to be finished. And it's described as he was a little depressed. Now, is that not the type of consciousness that we would all like? It is definitely the case that devotees express emotions when they're in difficult situations. And our process of bhakti is not about negating emotion, it's about transcendental emotion for the Lord. Now that emotion sometimes, because this material world is so hellish, and because a devotee, although in a very high sense he has already been saved from all his previous sinful actions, but it's still described that he may have some remnants of sinful mentality still in the mind. So certain external effects may be exhibited, which externally seem as if the devotee is getting a reaction for material misdeeds. But that is not really the case, because those situations are arranged by Krishna for that devotee's specific advancement. Krishna sees that devotee's condition and gives him whatever is necessary in accordance with his mentality in order to advance. Now, when those situations happen to a person, unfortunate situations, devotees may become a little despondent. And that's quite natural. There may be a grieving process even if someone loses someone very dear to them. This is quite normal, quite accepted. But the difference between the grieving or the lamentation or the miserable condition of a devotee and that of a normal human being is that for a devotee, first of all, it is minimized, very much minimized, the extent of suffering that the devotee... It is very much minimized, the extent of the suffering that the devotee experiences. Secondly, that suffering and that miserable condition is only for a short period. Because very soon, very quickly, and especially if that devotee happens to be in the association of other devotees, he very, very quickly receives the shelter and the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And that gives him relief from all that distress, very shortly. In a wider sense, we may go through so many sufferings in our life. As devotees, we struggle with so many things. They say spiritual life is difficult. They also say material life is impossible. Still, that difficulty in spiritual life should not be ignored. It's there, but it is only for a short period. Ultimately, all our difficulties, all our austerities, they are not there to earn some great position in this world, to earn a lot of money, to become particularly wealthy, particularly beautiful. That's not the goal of our austerities. The goal is to come to Krishna. And Krishna's guarantee is that sooner or later, if that is your desire, and you follow a process, to the extent that you follow the process properly, and to the extent that Krishna feels merciful to you, that according to that speed, this miserable material existence will be completely finished. There are so many miseries in this material world. We are not meant to be suffering them. And a devotee takes great shelter from all these examples. The Bhagavatam isn't just a collection of stories of great exalted sages who are wandering around with halos, benedicting everyone where they go. It describes real examples. Obviously, only choice examples are to be found in the Bhagavatam. The best examples, sadam sadam samudritam, only the cream of all the different examples that are around in the Vedic literatures are found in here. Because they are very powerful. They explain devotees who go through different stages of their devotional service, different setbacks, different advancements, different methods by which they can be temporarily held back or temporarily, through benedictions, advance. Then they also describe the supremely mysterious position of the Lord. Here the Lord has appeared, he chops the head of the crocodile and addresses Gajendra. Now, of course, this whole series, this is one of the Lord's mysterious activities. This whole series of pastimes began when Parikshit Maharaj was trying to understand the impartiality of the Lord. Why is it that the Lord incarnates and protects his devotee Prahlad and kills the demon, Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha? Why does he kill the crocodile? Now, why does he take sides of Gajendra? Why doesn't he save the crocodile? Why doesn't he think the crocodile needs a good meal? I should give him a good meal. That could have been an alternative thought of the Lord, if indeed he is truly fair to everyone. So these are aspects, we won't go into that now, that's a whole long seminar. But these are different aspects that come out. The Lord is completely mysterious, completely in his own transcendental position, and not subject to criticism or censor by anyone. Of course, many fools will always criticize and censor him. And even the Lord sometimes is not saved from curses. Who can think of a situation when the Lord himself was cursed? Yes, Prabhuji? Srimati Tulsi Devi. Yes. Yes. Mahaprabhu accepted that curse. He was very happy for it. Yes, what is that pastime? on Krishna. Yes, this is an important one, because this pastime came as the result of a curse from Gandhari. After the battle of Kurukshetra, now Mother Gandhari, although she knew right at the beginning and she knew throughout the episode that her sons were in the wrong, and she knew that all of them would be totally destroyed as a result of this, because there were so many great pronouncements to this effect. All the elders in the assemblies had said this. Bhishma Dev had declared that you're behaving like this, it is guaranteed that in accordance with Bhishma Dev's, in accordance with Bhima's vow, you will definitely all be killed. Vidura also advised her in that way. And so everyone in the Kuru house knew that this was going to happen. Dhritarashtra also knew, but he was resigned to the fact that all his sons were going to die, all 100 of them, as Bhima had made this vow. Now, of course, in due course of time, the words of Krishna, the words of his devotees do not go in vain. And exactly as it happened, as this prophecy happened, it happened. One by one, all the sons were killed. But now Mother Gandhari was very much upset. Now, she was upset at Krishna. Because although from the beginning, she knew that Krishna was a Supreme Lord, is very, very powerful, and that everything runs according to his desire. Still, when something happens to us that we don't actually like, it still brings out certain ill feelings, for at least hopefully just for a short period. Even if we know that if we behave in a certain way, a due consequence will happen. Like for instance, people who smoke, they know that I'm nothing against smokers, but just as an example, everyone is telling you that smoking is bad. So it's natural that if you carry on smoking, you will develop certain diseases or certain consequences of that. Yet still, when those things happen, people get heart attacks, people get blocked lungs, so they still feel resentment. And if they're maybe slightly pious, but not fully pious, they think, why has God done this to me? So now, even though we can see something developing in due course by a series of actions, Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki, still, when the end result happens, it is can be very much disturbing. So for Mother Gandhari, although she knew that all her sons would be killed, still, it wasn't palatable. And so finally, when she saw Krishna, she was a great ascetic. And without Krishna's help, her sons would probably have survived. Well, definitely have survived. He was instrumental in bringing about their downfall, despite so many wrongs they did. It's the whole story of the Mahabharata. So much sinful activity was committed by them. So she cursed Krishna at the end, that you say that this is all the fault of my sons, and I accept that my sons are very sinful. But still, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and nothing happens without your sanction. Therefore, I hold you responsible for this entire disaster. You are responsible for the victory of the Pandavas, and you are responsible for the death of my sons. Therefore, I curse you, that just as you encourage the Pandavas to kill my sons, some of them by questionable means, such as hitting Duryodhan below the belt, things like that. Questionable means, we can say. In a similar way, you will also be killed in a very unimpressive way, in an inauspicious way, by an arrow in the foot, by some hunter. So this came to pass. Krishna accepted this curse. Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted the curse, that you know, you will never have a place to stay, you will, you know, forever be wandering, etc. Krishna accepted this curse because he knew the pastimes had to end. And this was now the trigger. So Krishna is very intelligent. He himself, you can see a lot of his pastimes, they act as a result of curses by rishis. Now we shouldn't think that the curses of the rishis are anything ordinary. What is the most striking example of the curse of a rishi which brings about great spiritual... Manigriva and Nalakuveri, yes. They were released from their curse by Krishna. Who did what? We sing it, don't we? Yes, exactly. And he pulled the wooden grinding mortar and broke these trees and released them. So, Krishna does that. What is another great example? Who? Agasura. Can you explain the story? Oh, because he was bent in different places. Yeah. He acted to assist in the Lord's pastimes. Became a place of pleasure pastimes of the cowherd boys after he was killed. Yes? Yes. That's what I was waiting for. This is the setting for the entire Bhagavatam. A curse by a Brahmana boy, somehow completely inappropriately cursed the king, and the king welcomes this curse. He declares to the great sages, I do not care what this magical bird is, this takshak bird, this snake bird, or whatever magical thing that this Brahmana boy has concocted. Please let it come and bite me immediately. I just wish that you carry on chanting the glories of Lord Krishna so that I may live in that environment. So when a great saintly person gives some curse, we know it's for some great benefit. We shouldn't go looking for those curses, but I've listed so many examples now of devotees who have somehow inadvertently, accidentally, perhaps by the inspiration of the Lord, somehow done things that have caused them to be cursed. But there is no loss or diminution. This is the important principle that comes out from this. These are very, very reassuring pastimes. Neha vikramanashosti pratyavayanu vidyate svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahatobayat. Even a little advancement on this path of devotional service, can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. There is never any loss or diminution. So Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, this topic is explored at some length. Krishna says, what happens to the yogi who tries to advance but doesn't manage in this lifetime, and then he falls away? Is he not like a riven cloud who is neither situated in the material world nor in the spiritual world? It's a good question. No? Sometimes devotees ask this question. If I engage in devotional service, I may have to give up my job, my career, so many things, my standing in society, my situation in society. And then, if somehow I don't make it as the topmost sannyasi, as the topmost maharaj, is it all lost? Devotees may ask this question. But the Lord tells us very clearly that, first of all, the external status of your devotional exhibition does not matter. That's the first point. Second, even if you genuinely do stop your devotional service, which is not recommended, by the way, but still, if somehow you do stop, ultimately there is no loss. Isn't it? We just simply carry on where we left off. Prabhupada makes that point quite clear. We engage in devotional service, we carry on with our efforts, and in our next life, we carry on. But the problem is that you may have to take multiple births if there is some major discrepancy. So best to try to alleviate that. This birth alone has brought us so much difficulty. We struggle so much to engage in devotional service just based on our conditionings in this life. Imagine each one of us, we have conditionings based on where we're from, cultures that we've grown up with, ideas that we have, our mentalities according to the work we've done, the people we've grown up around, the education we've received. So many different aspects go to create a whole concoction of ideas and drives in our mind which often hold us back. And this is the verdict of great personalities, that they wish to finally end this. Dvai me ananya vishaya matir madhu pate sakrit ratim udvahatat adha gange vo gamudhanvati. This is Queen Kunti. She prays, O Lord of Madhu, please let my attention be constantly drawn to you and not be drawn to my kinsmen, relatives, my activities, my situation. Let my attention be drawn to you as the Ganges forever flows towards the sea without interruption. This is her conclusion after an entirely extensive period of struggling to deal with her sons who are always getting into trouble. It's a very tricky period that she went through. But she continues to explain that Janma Aishwarya Shruta Shribir Edamana Madapuma Naivaratya Vidhatumai Tuama Kinchana Gochara. These are the component aspects of that confusion we have in our mind. The desire for janma, birth, desire for aishwarya, opulence, janma, aishwarya, shruta, learning, shribir, wealth. So many, these things all combine to create a whole list of aspirations. And therefore a person who is desiring to progress in these material areas, they cannot surrender fully to the Supreme Lord. They have to be tvama kinchana gochara, they have to be free from the desire to increase their material situation. They have to be fatigued. So Gajendra definitely became fatigued in a very visible way. But we can see how devotees will also become fatigued. Actually, every single person becomes fatigued of material endeavor in due course. Some of them honestly admit it and they turn to Krishna. Others carry on, chewing the chewed, doing the same things that have brought them misery birth after birth after birth. Eventually, after an extensive period of suffering, such a person may get the mercy of a devotee. They may somehow come into contact with the understanding that there is a Supreme Lord and that this suffering that I'm voluntarily bringing upon myself doesn't really need to be there. Simply by surrendering to the Lord, simply by turning to the Lord, this miserable situation, which I have assumed is permanent, can be ended just like that. So the devotees are very much capable of doing that. And others also, as well as the Supreme Lord, other demigods, they also come to assist. The demigods are always servants of the Lord. In this verse specifically, the demigods mention that they came with the Lord. Gajendra was praying exclusively to the Supreme Lord, not to the demigods. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur hints that the demigods were slightly offended. Because why didn't he approach us? I mean, we are the controllers, the enactors in the universe. Why didn't he approach us? So, well, that's explained that Gajendra was solely devoted to the Supreme Lord. And the demigods are his parts and parcels. So Prabhupada explains that as a verse, a very important verse for us, yathātaror mūla niṣecanena tṛpyanti tat skanda bhujopashāka pranopahāra chayatendriyānam tateva sarvārhana machyuteja. Just as by offering water to the root of a tree, one nourishes the branches, twigs and everything else, and just as by supplying food to the stomach, the senses and the limbs of the body are enlivened and energized, so simply by serving the Supreme Lord, all his parts and parcels are automatically satisfied, which includes the demigods. This is a very important verse. We often quote this, how Krishna is the tree, and by watering the root of the tree, all other entities are satisfied, because they are his parts and parcels. So the demigods, if they were feeling like this, still, ultimately, they are servants of the Supreme Lord. So even devotees sometimes get a little confused about the real situation of things. But still, ultimately, they surrender to Krishna. They may think for a short while that, oh, I can manage without Krishna. I can try on my own for a little while to do something. But sooner or later, they actually realize that, no, hang on. Except apart from Krishna, there is nothing else in this world. I have no other shelter except for Krishna. There's nothing that I can actually achieve in this world apart from Krishna. And so eventually they come to that point where they surrender to Krishna. It is always a very good practice for devotees to understand the position of the demigods. As Prabhupada explains, the worship of the demigods is not necessary for someone who is strictly practicing devotional service. However, there are numerous examples also of great individuals, Priyavrat Maharaj, Prithu Maharaj, who specifically, as part of the cultural situation, did not hesitate to offer worship to the demigods as part of their yajñas, but fully understanding that they are actually worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the demigods are his limbs. It's a very important difference. Generally, when people worship demigods, it is for some material benefit. They're expecting the demigods to give them something. They want nice bank balance, nice car, whatever it is. But if the worship of the Supreme Lord is the priority, and then according to the situation, some worship of demigods or respect to demigods is probably a better word, is carried out to facilitate that, then that is completely accepted. We should also be very careful not to criticize the demigods. Te jiyasam na doshaya. One who is extremely powerful is not subject to contamination by insignificant lesser entities. So we should be very careful. Demigods are exalted persons. They accompany Krishna. No Tom, Dick and Harry can just accompany Krishna during his pastimes. It is not the case that if we feel the Lord, we have offended the Lord, that immediately the Lord takes us to wherever his pastimes are happening. It's not the case. Demigods, they are the rulers of the universe. They are appointed in those positions by the mercy of the Lord. So, those are some points from this verse. Demigods and how the Lord protects his devotees. So, any questions, comments?